From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
When the criminal justice system lets you down, you have to find alternative ways of reaching solutions for justice. And you've got to look not just nationally, but internationally to find new solutions.
Today, we'll speak with a lawyer for a British family. It is Britain's most famous victim of racist violence, Stephen Lawrence, and what happened when the justice system failed. We'll go to Kosovo, where Albanians have attacked French peacekeepers, wounding more than 40 of them. And we'll talk with an ex-McNamara whiz kid, also designed the F-16. And in California, more than 100 young people protest at the Hilton Hotel, one of the sponsors of California Proposition 21. All that and more coming up on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Aetna, the number one U.S. life and health insurer, is considering making an unprecedented public apology and restitution payment over profits it made from insuring slaves in America 150 years ago. The life insurance policies, issued in the 1850s, were one of the first lines of business underwritten by the Hartford, Connecticut-based insurer, which now has 47 million customers worldwide and annual revenues of $26 billion. Payments on the policies were due to slaves' owners, not the slaves' families. An apology from Aetna would be the first from an American corporation over its involvement in slavery of black Americans. DeAdria Farmer Pellman, a lawyer and activist who has single-handedly petitioned several U.S. corporations to apologize for their involvement in slavery, said by insuring the lives of human beings in the way that we insure industrial machinery, Aetna profited from this crime against humanity. Her demand for an apology and restitution comes as victims of Nazi persecution and their descendants are negotiating compensation payments from German companies over slave labor charges and unpaid insurance policies. In Washington, those talks are taking place. 2 days of talks to divide close to $5 billion in German compensation for some Nazi victims ended in recriminations because of a dispute over who should pay for some Nazi-era insurance policies. The talks bring together the German government and industry, 5 East and Central European governments, Israel, organizations representing Jewish and other victims, and lawyers with class action suits against German companies. The main beneficiaries of the German fund are expected to be an estimated 250,000 slave laborers, mainly Jews, and about 1 million people, mostly from Eastern Europe, who were pressed into service as forced laborers during World War II. The aim is to compensate people forced to work for the Nazis and people who lost property and other assets to Nazi Aryanization policies, as well as to commemorate the victims of the Holocaust through education and memorials. This news from South Bend, Indiana. 2 off-duty police officers working security at a Denny's restaurant acted improperly when they arrested 4 black college students over a sign that fell off the wall. This according to restaurant company officials. Denny's officials said yesterday they fired the 2 police officers who allegedly used pepper spray on a handcuffed student and slammed the head of another into a car trunk, bloodying her nose. The chain has been stung by a series of incidents involving people of color. It paid $45.7 million in 1994 to settle a discrimination suit by black customers. Bill Bradley is readying an endorsement of Al Gore as he scripts his exit from the Democratic presidential campaign. John McCain has canceled further campaign events amid signs his presidential challenge is near an end. Gore and Texas Governor George W. Bush reached out to their defeated rivals and jabbed at one another as they pivoted toward the general election. Bush labeled the vice president an agent of Washington, and Gore said Bush is too cozy with the extreme right, as personified by the National Rifle Association and religious broadcaster Pat Robertson. A day after Vice President Al Gore challenged Governor Bush to a mutual halt in raising the unlimited campaign donations known as soft money, Gore aides are launching a program to help the Democrats raise $35 million in such funds over the next few months. Several Democratic fundraisers have been invited to a luncheon where, with Mr. Gore, he's expected to ask each of them to raise at least $100,000 in soft money before the party's convention in mid-August. In a tragedy overlooked by the outside world, Madagascar has reportedly been left with more than twice as many homeless people as Mozambique after two cyclones swept through the island on their way to the African continent. The island's government estimates 600,000 people have been left homeless, and it's registered 50 dead since the cyclone struck the north of the country. The World Food Program said yesterday it'll divert some food aid to the island, which in the past 2 weeks has suffered the full impact of cyclones. A representative of UNICEF, the UN children's body, said the cyclone-stricken island could become the next Mozambique. And that's some of the news at this hour.
You can't have tint on my curb about him asphyxiation. And you can't have strike garden about our suffocation. You can't have Colin Roach if him really shoot himself. And you can't ask Vincent Graham if he's him stab himself. But you can ask the commissioner about the license to kill. Ask Sir Paul Condon about the license to kill. You can't ask the Douglas them about the new style baton. And you can't ask Tony Hassan about him dead by neglect. You can't ask Marlon Downs if him have any regret. And you can't ask El Gamal about the mystery I'm dead. But you can ask Dame Barbara about the license to kill. Ask the DPP about the license to kill.
You are listening to Lytton Kwesi Johnson on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The BBC reports today that a mole at NATO headquarters is alleged to have leaked secrets of the Kosovo campaign to the Yugoslav military command. Information leaked during the first 2 weeks of the campaign included targets to be hit and precise flight paths, according to an internal classified report drawn up for senior U.S. defense officials. NATO spokesperson Jamie Shea said there's no evidence for the allegations contained in a BBC television documentary called Moral Combat, NATO at War. It's going to be broadcast on Sunday. Details of the deployment of NATO reconnaissance operations were allegedly given to Belgrade, and enabling the Serbs to move troops and equipment out of the target zones. The BBC program says that General Wesley Clark, NATO's supreme Allied commander, was convinced that there was a mole inside the organization. Meanwhile, French troops have prevented UN police from investigating violence in northern Mitrovica, in which 40 people were wounded. More than 40 people, including 16 French KFOR soldiers, were injured on Tuesday there after an altercation between an ethnic Albanian and a Serb in the Serb-dominated northern part of the city led to shots being fired and grenades exploding. We're joined right now by Sputnik Kalambi, who is a reporter in Kosovo. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Sputnik.
Hi, thanks.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us the latest from Mitrovica and what caused the Serb population or members of it to attack the French troops?
Well, Mitrovica has reported calm today and yesterday, as you said in the news. Tuesday saw one of the most violent bouts of fighting between KFOR troops and involving both local Serbs and Albanians. There seems to be uncertainty exactly about what happened. The French KFOR, which is in charge of Mitrovica, initially said that the violence had been sparked when a grenade was thrown at an Albanian home, and that's what led to the unrest. And subsequently, he went back on that and said the Albanians had attacked the Serbs. An Albanian youth had fired at a young Serb man. Subsequently, apparently, some Albanians had thrown hand grenades at inquisitive school children and then at French soldiers. And that's when things went out of control and clashes broke out. But since then, I mean, KFOR is kind of keeping tight about it, and they haven't given us a definitive version about exactly what happened. But I do believe four Albanians have been arrested since then.
We're talking to Sputnik Kalambi. She is speaking to us on a satellite phone. We understand it's extremely difficult on landlines to get into anyone in Pristina, the capital of Kosovo. Can you talk about these escalating attacks on troops and also in the last few weeks, what happened with the American troops who were there and one of the American troops who was charged with raping and killing an Albanian girl?
Well, it's interesting. I mean, one hears a lot of criticism about the way the French KFOR troops have been conducting themselves. They are accused very often by the Albanians of having a pro-Serb bias, and some people have actually reported being present when French KFOR soldiers were apparently taking orders from what they called Serb thugs. I mean, it's true there are Serb extremists in northern Mitrovica. There are reports of busloads of pro-Milosevic loyalists being coming into the region, which is very close to the border with Serbia, and also very close to Pristina. But what is interesting is while you have all this criticism about the way the French troops are conducting themselves, there's very, very low-key reaction to American, let's not say atrocities, but the way the Americans have been conducting themselves, and starting with the rape and murder of that 11-year-old Albanian girl compared to protests one has seen elsewhere. Here, the reaction was extremely low-key. There was anger, definitely, but the Americans are generally considered to be their allies here, and it seems that the Americans cannot do wrong, even though you have reports of American KFOR soldiers going into areas, even Albanian areas, where they go into bars, into pubs, and are very high-handed in the way they treat people they consider to be potential suspects. And it's an interesting thing. Nobody wants to publicly criticize the Americans here.
Some people who are listening may not, because it's gotten so little attention, even realize what happened with this American soldier. Is there also a second one implicated in covering up the crime?
Well, I mean, that also is being kept extremely, extremely tight. No information is filtering out. The trial of the American GI involved, charged with the shooting, apparently began at the U.S. Camp Bondsteel here in Kosovo, this huge American military base. But there's absolutely no information that's filtering out, absolutely none.
And again, though, what he is charged with, when did this happen?
This happened more than a month ago.
That the killing
The killing and the rape, yes. And there was apparently an eyewitness involved. We don't know anything about what happened to that eyewitness, whether he has come out with more information. But as I say, KFOR is keeping its lips tightly sealed, and so are the Americans. There's literally no information at all about what's happening with that GI and where the case against him is going.
Again, I apologize for the quality of the sound to our listeners, but it is quite amazing to be talking directly to reporter Sputnik Colombi, who is in Kosovo right now, speaking to us on a satellite phone. I was just watching an interview with the man in charge of the UN operation in Kosovo, Bernard Kouchner, and he was talking about the problem of the United Nations mandate and that Kosovar Albanians perceive the peacekeeping forces as being against them because part of their mandate was not to lead toward Kosovar Albanian independence. Is it unusual that the Albanians feel that the French troops are biased toward the Serbs, or do the Albanians feel that all the UN troops are biased toward the Serbs simply because they are not enforcing independence?
No, but I think most of the Albanians are also aware of the whole ambiguity of the UN resolution that ended the conflict last year with the June deadline coming closer. That's when they have to review the agreement they made with the Belgrade regime about what the status of Kosovo is. I think everybody's waiting to find out what happens. I mean, that's exactly what Bernard Kouchner as well said when he was in New York, appealing to the UN Security Council members to define what they meant by political autonomy for Kosovo. I don't think anybody believes that there's any way that Kosovo can remain within the Yugoslav Federation, and given tensions on the boil in Montenegro and chances that Montenegro might also eventually end up breaking off from the Federal Republic of Yugoslavia, there will be no Federal Republic of Yugoslavia for even Kosovo to be part of. But to your other question, I don't think that there is that kind of tension or anger or hostility towards UN troops in general. I think definitely the French, the Italians, and the Greeks are also, and obviously the Russians are viewed with suspicion. But generally, by and large, the Americans, the British, and even the Germans are considered to be friends of the Albanians. But I think the problem is elsewhere. There are 30,000 troops, KFOR troops in Kosovo, which is, I think, a huge number of troops. But very often, you talked about the situation in Mitrovica. What they need is not troops with tanks and AK-47s and really sophisticated weapons, but police trained in riot control and things like that, which is sadly lacking. And of the 5,000 police force that Bernard Kouchner had asked for, people. They're less than 2,000, and some of them come from, I mean, from places as far apart as, you know, Bangladesh or Senegal or Ghana, who don't necessarily have the experience to deal with the situation here, or who have never been confronted with a situation like this.
What about the money? What about the money to deal with the reconstruction of bombed-out Kosovo?
Well, precisely, this is also something that everybody says here, Serbs and Albanians, that there was money enough for the bombing last year and that went into the billions of dollars, and yet for the reconstruction of Kosovo, the money is coming in extremely slowly. In fact, by the end of March, the UN will have no money in its kitty, and Vanna Kushner has been making desperate pleas for that money to come in. And this is where the international mission here, I think, is undermined. I mean, they are undermined by the unwillingness of their own governments, in a way, to put their money where their mouths are. And having said that they are going to protect the Kosovars, there is no money now to help in the reconstruction. And just, I think, a couple of days ago, the U.S. Senate, or the upper house, approved a $2 billion aid package that Clinton had asked for the U.S. military here in Kosovo. But of the only $93 million that he asked for the reconstruction of Kosovo, they only approved $2 million. So $2 billion for the army and $2 million for reconstruction. And the problems caused by the lack of progress made in the reconstruction, you see everywhere, chronic power and water shortages. Now the weather, and it's spring, so it's almost spring, so it's more bearable. But in January and February, you had temperatures coming down to minus 29 sometimes. Reports of people living in plastic tents in some places, and no power and no water. And yet you have this huge international presence here. You have these huge Toyotas and Land Rovers and the Coca-Cola police, as they're called, because of their red and white colors of the police cars here. There's money for the international community, but there doesn't seem to be money for the reconstruction of Kosovo.
What, for example, does the U.S. military base look like and have?
Well, I haven't yet had a chance to go into the U.S. Military base at Vonsi, but reports I've heard say that it's really a state-of-the-art military base. And they have a sauna and a gym for troops to, you know, work out, a chapel, hot water, cold water, power 24 hours a day. And I think 3 weeks ago there was this story going around here that British KFOR troops had to kind of, you know, rough it out in tents while their American counterparts actually lived in luxury in Bonsi, at any rate.
You're in Kosovo right now as part of an unusual group of reporters who are there. Can you talk about what you're doing?
Well, this is in a way part of the UN mission here. This is a radio station called Blue Sky Radio, which is financed by the Swiss government and run by a Swiss NGO called Hirondelle, which operates in several other post-conflict situations. They had set up a radio station in the past in the Great Lakes area in the Congo. They have a news agency in Arusha, Tanzania, covering the International Tribunal, and they've set up this radio station here, but which is part of the UN radio station. So we broadcast also UN news and what the international community is doing here. But what is interesting is that we're trying to make this a multi-ethnic place. We have Serb, Turkish, and Turkish-speaking and Albanian journalists working here, and we produce news programs in Albanian, Turkish, and Serbian, mostly Albanian, because for all people's hopes and desires, maybe, I don't know how long these desires will last, to keep Kosovo multi-ethnic, it is increasingly a mono-ethnic place. So I suppose it stands to reason that most of the broadcasts are in Albanian. But the idea is to get these young reporters who have come from a totally different style of functioning in the past, which was very authoritarian, which was very more propaganda than news, and definitely kind of biased reporting, trying to get them to report independently, including about problems faced by Albanians and crimes committed by Albanians against other minorities. It's not always easy, but I think we're getting there, and I think they understand that this is extremely important if they believe in the reconstruction of Kosovo.
More importantly,
a democratic Kosovo.
You mentioned the issue of an Albanian paper publishing the name of Serbs suspected of atrocities and the problems that poses.
Yes, well, precisely. The OSCE, the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe, recently, a couple of weeks ago, I think it was 10 days ago, came out with a very, very strong call on journalists and newspaper editors here in Kosovo to behave with responsibility. This after a couple of local newspapers published the names of people they called suspected war criminals or paramilitaries or who had committed atrocities in the past, and they've actually gone so far as to publish their names and their places of work without, however, publishing any evidence to back up their allegations. And this obviously leads to problems. I mean, there are reports of killings of minorities every day, more Serbs than Albanians and other communities as well. So in this kind of context, when anything, and rumors especially, can lead to unforetold or uncontrollable consequences, it's extremely important that journalists maintain that sense of responsibility.
Well, Sputnik Colombia, we want to thank you for being with us, speaking to us from Pristina, Kosovo. When we come back, we are going to go to Washington to speak with two military people, a Pentagon analyst and a former specialist to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, to talk about looking at the way the U.S. military as part of NATO conducted itself. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! We'll be back in a minute. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. We're joined now by Chuck Spinney, a Pentagon analyst who is one of the founders of the military reform movement and a critic of military spending in the NATO war in Kosovo, speaking for himself, not for the Pentagon. Also, Pierre Spray is with us, former specialist to Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's Systems Analysis Office, known as one of McNamara's whiz kids. He led the Air Force technical design of the F-16 and A-10, which played a primary role in the Gulf War. His specialty is debunking myths about defense technology. Let me go to you, Pierre Spray, first. We have just gotten this word from BBC. They're going to be putting out a documentary on Sunday that says that in the first weeks of the bombing, NATO was sharing the targets with about 600 top people, and that there was a mole within NATO who was giving this information to the Serb leaders, and they were then moving troops out from those areas. Does this surprise you? Is it something you believe? NATO's denying this.
I really don't have any insight into that. Frankly, I don't think the Serbs much needed a mole. The NATO bombing campaign was so predictable, they could have just sat down with a clean sheet of paper and figured out, you know, what targets were going to be hit.
And as we look back on the bombing campaign, and your specialty is military technology, what do you see as the how do you assess the military equipment that was used?
Well, as you know, NATO has crowed considerably about the tremendous success of the bombing campaign and the success of the key technologies that were used, particularly stealth and precision-guided munitions, that is, just guided missiles to hit ground targets. And they claim they got tremendous precision, hit the targets they needed to hit, and had such a success that they forced Milosevic to the bargaining table. Frankly, that's all hogwash. Taking it one at a time, the stealth technology they used, which was embodied principally in the B-2 bomber and the F-117, you know, was and is basically a fraud. Any ancient Russian radar dating back to World War II can see the so-called stealthy airplanes. You can forget about that. That simply had no effect on the war at all. The precision-guided munitions, the missiles, the air-to-ground missiles, which were used in very large numbers, basically, I would assess had essentially no military effect whatsoever. the Serbian army came out of this bombing campaign totally intact, well and able and, you know, perfectly capable of fighting as they were when they started. In fact, as you know, the initiation of the bombing campaign basically unleashed the Serbian army in a very quick ethnic cleansing mop-up, almost a blitzkrieg in Kosovo. And our bombing campaign did nothing to stop that, nothing whatsoever. So the military effect was minuscule. As you can see by, for instance, the tiny count of tanks destroyed, now that the war is over and we occupy the ground, it's pretty clear that for all of the thousands of missiles flung, we wound up killing about 14 dilapidated ancient tanks and 12 World War II vintage armored self-propelled guns. That's about the effect on the armor. We had essentially no effect on the air defense system. It was intact. The Serbian logistics worked well, and the army was well-fed and well-fueled and when they left Kosovo. And very obviously, they had no problem communicating with each other.
So what was the point of the NATO campaign?
Well, that's an interesting question. Obviously, part of it had to do with the fact that NATO is very hungry for a mission in a world where there's no Russian threat anymore. And so they've expanded their borders beyond being a defensive alliance against a Russian threat, whatever that was. And now they're looking for other missions, other places to apply military force. So they've been very keen since, you know, for years now, to be involved in the various Yugoslav crises. So part of this, and of course that dates back to the origins of NATO. You have to remember that NATO, in its inception, was really an alliance to keep peacetime military expenditures high. I mean, the excuse for NATO, needless to say, was that it was a defensive alliance against a terrific threat. But in reality, if you go back to the very original NATO treaty and what people were debating at that point, it really was an alliance to create a standing army in peacetime for us at a very high price and for the European nations. And it's been faithful to that mission ever since. They're still looking for ways of keeping expenditures high. This is one of them. Of course, there's the political dimension. There are people involved in the Clinton administration, the Secretary of State, perhaps Clinton himself, who had an interest in seeming tough abroad in order to improve an image and a voter position at home. So between politics and money, that's the real incentive for going and bombing a country that, you know, that's totally outside our security interests.
Pierre Spray, again, one of McNamara's whiz kids, led the Air Force technical design of the F-16 and the A-10. We're also joined by Chuck Spinney, who is a Pentagon analyst, speaking for himself today on the program. Chuck Spinney, what do you see as the future scenarios for Kosovo? And do you see a NATO or U.S. bombing in the picture again?
I'm not sure I see a NATO or U.S. bombing in the picture again. First of all, one of the things people do not deal with clearly in Washington is we can't predict the future. We don't know what's going to happen. But if we look at the situation on the ground in Kosovo, basically there are several factors that help us bound the problem. The Albanians and Serbs hate each other now. KFOR is caught in the middle. The preponderance of ethnic cleansing going on in Kosovo now is being done by the Albanians. There's a small amount being done by the Serbs in North Mitrovica. And Kosovo is also collapsing into chaos, if you read the news reports. And I've talked to people on the scene, and they confirm that. A second factor shaping the future is that there is the conditions for democracy are simply not present. There's no mutual trust, mutual respect, or toleration. And without those, all democratic formulas for any kind of self-governing multi-ethnic society based on the principle of proportional representation become practical impossibilities because losers in elections won't respect winners, and they'll result the force. So if you look at these two factors together, basically they're telling us that some form of segregation's in the future, whether we like it or not. And as I see it, there's three basic categories. One we might refer to as de jure partition, essentially lop off part of Kosovo and give it to the Serbs. The only candidate for that is the northern sector. There's problems where Mitrovica is. There's problems with that because, first of all, it ratifies ethnic cleansing, which we intervened to stop. Some people argue that it would set a bad precedent. It might set the conditions for a partition of Albanians out of Macedonia, for example. There's economic problems with that. What little wealth exists in Kosovo is concentrated in the minerals in the north, and there's some real complicated ownership issues regarding the mines and the smelters and the processing facilities. In fact, there's even some foreign interests involved. And finally, another factor arguing against partition is a strategic. The northern sector would essentially be a doormat into Kosovo for a future invasion by Serbia at some time. From the Albanians' perspective, partition would leave a non-viable state always open to attack.
Haven't the Albanians also formed a sort of new wing of the KLA that would go after areas that are not a part of Kosovo,
right.
The
They're
eastern
Serbia?
They're
trying to get into what they call eastern Kosovo and have that added to Kosovo, which is...
Eastern Serbia, you mean?
They call it eastern Kosovo, but it's southern Serbia.
Mm-hmm.
And their border regions, where about 70,000 Albanians live, and I'm going to get to that in a minute. So I just described the issue of partition. The second one is what you might refer to as ghettoization or cantonization. Basically, that's a continuation of the status quo, where the Serbs are concentrated in ghettos and protected by KFOR. The problems with that is, first of all, there's no end state. We'll be there indefinitely. Christopher Hill, the chief negotiator at the Rambouillet, said in a speech last week in Rhode Island that we'll be there for 20 years. Tim Judah argued in a New York Times editorial, he's a Balkan expert, that we could be there as long as 55 years. Another factor going against ghettoization or cantonization is ghettos become breeding grounds for hatred and revolutionary discontent, particularly if they exist over intergenerational time spans. And finally, it reinforces our failing policies. There's no real plan in ghettoization for mutating the segregation into an autonomous multicultural province. The final category of outcome, and there's no politically correct way to say this, is what I label expurgation. Basically, that can take place in two forms, as I see it. One would be a population exchange, like India or Pakistan in the 1940s, and Greece and Turkey in the 1920s. Both of those were very bloody, by the way. If you look at that, essentially the way you might want to think about a population exchange would be the southern Serbian Albanians go to Kosovo, and the Serbians in North Kosovo go to Serbia. That would be an example of one. The problems now are that NATO's actively engaged in ethnic cleansing. It's not just ratifying it. It's actively doing it and defining mutually acceptable a mutually acceptable exchange, given the economic disparities, population distribution, and cultural heritage, would be very difficult. And finally, it may set the stage for more exchanges. And again, the example of the Albanians and Macedonia would be come to mind.
Everything you've laid out lays out a scenario of future serious tension.
Exactly.
The
and
problem
the final,
has clearly
the
not been solved in Kosovo.
There's two expurgation options. One's a population exchange. The last one is a blood purge. Basically, the scenario is exhausted, demoralized NATO units cut and run. And one of two things could happen. The Albanians could finish the job and clean the Serbs out of northern Kosovo and the pockets of Serbian population that are scattered throughout Kosovo. Or Serbia's undefeated army, and I agree with Pierre Spray's comments completely on this, they left that province intact. And I also agree with his numbers of kills. They seem to be have been confirmed by just about everybody, 14 tanks and 12 self-propelled howitzers or self-propelled artillery pieces. So you have a Serbian army that may be somewhat analogous to the German army in 1918, where that when they marched back into Germany, they didn't believe they were defeated. Well, in 1918, the Germans were defeated. The Serbian army could make a case that Milosevic sold them out, and they weren't defeated, and they may just decide to come back in and finish the job, and just come in with a brutal ethnic cleansing blitzkrieg a second time.
Let me just end with Pierre Spray asking, you think that the NATO bombing of Kosovo was a total failure?
Worse than a failure. It was the springboard for incredible injustices. And that's generically true of bombing campaigns. Bombing campaigns are no way to settle wars, either to win them or to create, just solutions. They do the opposite. They create, because they are a form of terrorism, they create conditions for endless trouble afterwards, and that's been true basically in every bombing campaign we've carried out. This is one of the earliest ones where we've done just a bombing campaign because we didn't want to risk anybody on the ground, and it's even worse than previous ones.
Well, I want to thank you both for being with us. Pierre Spray, former specialist with Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara's Systems Analysis Office, and Chuck Spinney, who is a current Pentagon analyst, but speaking for himself in his criticism of the NATO war in Kosovo. Both men spoke last week at a forum that was held by Cleveland Congressmember Dennis Kucinich. He's one of the congressmembers, a group of Republican and Democratic congressmembers, who sued over the bombing of Kosovo and Yugoslavia. You are listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! As we move now to San Francisco, California. About 150 young people were arrested yesterday after taking over the lobby of a Hilton hotel and holding a speak out to protest passage of a juvenile justice ballot measure. That's Proposition 21, which is approved overwhelmingly on Tuesday and will impose sweeping changes in the juvenile justice system, giving prosecutors the power to decide whether youths age 14 to 17 are tried and jailed as adults, and limiting judges' authority to refer children to treatment or probation rather than prison. We're joined right now by Robin Templeton, who is with the Third Eye Movement, which opposed Prop 21 and was in the Hilton lobby. Why the Hilton, Robin?
Good morning, Amy. The Hilton is one of a half dozen corporations that gave contributions to Pete Wilson, who thought he would make the Republican presidential primary, to fund Proposition 21. W. Barron Hilton gave the proposition $10 million. So young people up and down the state of California have been giving W. Barron Hilton a lot of grief, attempting to get him to make a statement against Prop 21. Last night, since the initiative did pass by a margin of 62%, young people converted the plush lobby of the four-star Hilton Hotel in downtown San Francisco into a modern-day sit-in site. It wasn't a lunch counter. It was a Hilton Hotel. Young people were saying, this represents money and politics, but it also represents our future. Why don't you fund our schools instead of prisons in California?
Robin Templeton, what happens now? There was this large youth coalition fighting Prop 21. You were up against, the former governor of California, but also Gray Davis, the current governor, supported this initiative. Is that right?
He absolutely did. He's a Democratic governor.
And you were up against these corporations, Chevron, Unocal, Pacific Gas and Electric, who say that they weren't taking a side, but simply supporting people's chance to vote on this issue.
And they only pled neutrality after young people confronted them repeatedly. Pacific Gas and Electric, Chevron, all made public statements of neutrality. In fact, Chevron said that the corporation did not support Proposition 21 in response to young people. Let me say also that law enforcement, as well as probation officers, as well as the Catholic Church, as well as every major newspaper in the state of California, soundly said no to Proposition 21 before the election. What happened was we're dealing in California with a very white middle-class electorate, which sees repeatedly in television coverage of young people the faces of so-called teen super predators. So young people are up against a huge tide of negative public attention against them. And the you asked what's going to happen now. I mean, the coalition of youth organizations under the umbrella Critical Resistance Youth Force is posing a counterforce to the prison system, which is highly concentrated in California. The coalition grew from about 8 organizations to over 38 and keeps growing all the time. Now, last night, 150 people were arrested in this peaceful, nonviolent civil disobedience sit-in. 100 people over 18 and 50 young people under 18 who said, we absolutely can't accept this in the state of California. The movement mobilized new voters, but more importantly, it's mobilized a new generation, which is seizing this opportunity to say, just as 40 years ago our predecessors broke the back of Jim Crow segregation in the South, here in California, where the prison contradiction is so strong, we are going to stop the prison industrial complex.
Well, Robin Templeton, I want to thank you very much for being with us, spokesperson for the Third Eye Movement, which opposed Prop 21. You know, if these corporations were declaring the neutrality, who poured money into the ballot initiative, why didn't they also pour money into the anti-ballot initiative?
What we're saying, and now we're also saying to the state of California, this initiative is going to cost $5 billion over the next 10 years to lock up about 9,000 more young people as adults. We're saying you need to put at least that much money into our schools.
How can the Third Eye Movement or the Critical Resistance Youth Force group be reached?
People should contact the Critical Resistance Youth Force at 510-444-0484. Again, that's 510-444-0484. There's also a wonderful website that's run entirely by young people called Schools Not Jails, all strung together, one word, schoolsnotjails.com. Where there's up-to-date information about the ongoing struggle in California. And I also want to say that young people clearly linked this protest last night and the ongoing movement to the murders of Amadou Diallo and Malcolm Ferguson in the state of New York. So there was huge solidarity there.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us, Robin Templeton, Third Eye Movement. You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! And when we come back from our break, we'll talk about what people can do when the justice system fails. And we're going to go across the Atlantic to look at a very important case. Stay with us.
Think I just MI5 and James Bond and police and soldier over North Island one. When it come to black people, Winston, some police in England got license for kill.
You're listening to Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Civil rights activist Al Sharpton was ordered to spend 10 days in jail yesterday for obstructing traffic during a July 4th weekend highway sit-in against racial profiling practices by New Jersey State Police. Angered by the 1998 shooting of 4 unarmed men of color by white state troopers in the New Jersey Turnpike, Sharpton and his followers had sought to disrupt traffic for tens of thousands of mainly white tourists who flocked to the East Coast gambling capital on summer holidays. Sharpton has recently led the protests over the police killing of Amadou Diallo. He led the major protests that led to about 1,000 arrests that ultimately, many believe, led to the indictment of the police officers, and then was there at the courthouse almost every day in Albany watching the trial unfold. Many people are now making international links between the Diallo case and other cases around the world. Stephen Lawrence is a black man who was killed by a white mob in Britain in 1993. The murder was compounded by a failed police investigation.
But it didn't stop there with the men who were charged with the murder being acquitted. It became a huge public case in Britain that led to a public inquiry of the circumstances around Stephen Lawrence's death and into the overall police force in Britain. The inquiry was published in February of 1999 and just had people just observed the year anniversary of that. We're joined right now for the attorney for the Stephen Lawrence family, named Matthew Ryder. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello. Thank you for inviting me.
It's good to have you with us. Now, Stephen Lawrence is not that familiar a name in the United States. Talk about the scope of the case in Britain.
To try and draw an analogy, one of the things that we've talked about is the fact that despite the world getting smaller in terms of information links, this sort of information and this sort of case isn't communicated as widely as it should be. And there is an amazing lack of knowledge about the Diallo case in England and about the Lawrence case in the US. To try and put it in perspective, the Lawrence case, to look at the significance it's had and the impact it's had, is probably comparable to the Rodney King case and the O.J. Simpson case combined in terms of the effect on public consciousness in England. It's a huge, huge case which has transformed every aspect of British society, in particular in relation to policing.
Explain what happened in 1993.
In 1993, Stephen Lawrence and a friend of his, two young black teenagers, were standing at a bus stop and were attacked by a white racist mob chanting racist names, and Stephen was stabbed. His friend escaped. Stephen lay dying in the street, and the police arrived. Fundamental medical assistance wasn't provided at the scene. He died shortly afterwards, and an investigation into the murder took place, which subsequently has been found to have been tainted by lots of more negligence, misconduct, and racism. And as a result, the people who murdered Stephen are still free.
Were they tried?
Prosecutions are brought against five people. Over legal technicalities and a combination of poor investigation, those prosecutions failed. The Lawrence family found themselves at the receiving end of a criminal justice system that couldn't provide them a remedy. Prosecutions failed. They tried civil remedies. They weren't working. And so by 1997, the family were refusing to give up, but they were running out of legal options. Double jeopardy applied to some of the suspects. So even though national newspapers had published the names of people they believed murdered Stephen, there was nothing, it seemed, that could be done. What the family did was really quite unique. They brought a private prosecution, which was a highly unusual step. It activated a 19th century statute. And they also...
Is that like a civil lawsuit in the United States where you sue for money?
No, it's a civil prosecution within the criminal process. It was unheard of for a murder case. I mean, no one had even thought it could be done. So they did that. Again, the criminal justice system let them down on evidential points because of the problem with the police investigation. So they lobbied for a public inquiry. Again, an unprecedented step. What they wanted to do, and what we wanted to do, was have a public forum in which the entire investigation into the Lawrence case and what had gone wrong was examined in public. Police officers would have to be called, cross-examined. The five suspects were called and cross-examined by lawyers for the family, by others. And as a result, the entire case developed a public persona and a public consciousness within the public mindset at the time as to exactly what happened. It wasn't simply a meetings of working parties within small groups or reports being published. It was an enormous public inquiry.
Who led the public inquiry?
In 1997, the incumbent Labour government were concerned about their position. There was an election taking place, and lobbying was made of politicians. The time was seized, in a sense, in terms of an election coming up. And promises were made about an inquiry being set up. It was really a public push. It was people power, in a sense. Immense dissatisfaction at what had happened in the Stephen Lawrence case. The black community in particular were at a very tense position in the fact that people felt that there was no remedy through the criminal justice system and the alternatives looked bleak. So as a result, the government set up this inquiry, chaired by somebody who was believed to be quite a conservative judicial figure, and also several clergy and other people were on the inquiry panel.
A four-man panel,
to look at all the issues surrounding the Lawrence case, why the investigation failed, the relationship between black people and the police, particularly black people as victims, but also how embracing other issues such as stop and frisk, and other issues surrounding the interface between what is, in a sense in England, an almost exclusively white police force and the black community and the community at large.
Now, what's interesting about this case, it wasn't the police who killed Stephen Lawrence.
No, and this is what made the case perhaps so important and perhaps what gave it the public push. The police didn't kill Stephen Lawrence, but what it highlighted was the intransigence and the difficulty that the police have in coming to terms with a black victim of crime. In other words, Stephen Lawrence was killed by racists, but rather than investigating as a racist crime, initially Stephen was looked, I mean, he's a model student, an A student, an incredibly respectable family, but there was they monitored whether he was a gang member or things of that nature, rather than seizing the time and looking at the evidence in the case and trying to collect evidence quickly. So what the inquiry dealt with is, excuse me, why the criminal justice system is failing, why the police investigation failed, and how the police approach black people generally as victims of crime, as suspects in criminal cases, and also how a family who's the victim of a crime is treated by the police. Because what was coming across was that family liaison techniques that should be adopted when someone is a victim of a crime weren't carried out properly.
Now, this is an important point you're raising in terms of being a victim of a crime, how the police deal with people of color.
Yeah, the concern is, I mean, at the time surrounding the Stephen Lawrence case, there were several other cases in which black people had been victim of racist crimes, as well as cases which involved people dying at the hands of the police. There were also several cases in which people had been murdered in racist situations. So you had people being killed, and the police weren't investigating it properly. So what this case was about really was looking at how the police should be investigating racist crimes, perhaps failing to classify a crime which clearly had a racial motive, failing to look at it in that way and examining it simply as just another incident or another crime.
What happened to the people who testified before the inquiry, like representatives of, I don't know what you would call your police commissioner, but...
Police were, in a sense, slammed by the inquiry, it's fair to say. The inquiry were very, very critical of the police approach. Police officers had never really been called to account for their actions in the way that they had been before this inquiry. That's what made it so groundbreaking, and that's why we're trying to bring a similar approach to the US in terms of policing, because police officers would come to the inquiry and use expressions such as colored. They would talk about colored people. They would talk about their own beliefs in relation to policing. They would talk about their lack of knowledge about how to classify racial crime. And suddenly all these things, which no one had ever realized had come out before, were coming out, and the public was getting an insight into how the police approach black people and approach racist crimes. It was really groundbreaking from that point of view. It was a window into what we call the canteen culture of the police force, what takes place in the police station that most of the time the public doesn't see.
Talking to Matthew Ryder, who is the attorney for the Lawrence family. He's come over to the United States really laying the groundwork for the Steve Lawrence parents to come over and meet with the Diallo family.
Yes.
To talk about approaches that could be taken here. We also have a very interesting situation where both the Amadou Diallo's mother and father, as well as Stephen Lawrence's parents, became very active and became spokespeople against issues of police brutality and corruption.
Absolutely. The Lawrence family were thrust into the public spotlight. I mean, again, to try and draw an analogy, Mr. and Mrs. Lawrence are, in American terms, Rosa Parks or Martin Luther King in England now. The public analysis of their case and their public profile is enormous. They are regular people who found themselves on the receiving end of a racist crime and then a police investigation, which the inquiry said was a shambles. So as a result of that, they have had to struggle and fight through. And what they're hoping to do is translate that into the American situation or build international links to help people in similar circumstances over here. To use the Diallo case as an example, the criminal justice system appears to have let the Diallo family down in terms of how their case has been dealt with. They need to look at what options they have and to look within the normal paradigm of approaches to the police and approaches to police misconduct isn't going to work. You'll be finding yourself repeating the same things over and over again. What we did in the Lawrence case was look outside the box, basically take a totally unique approach, utilize old statutes, utilize approaches that had never been seen before, a public inquiry that was really a push of people power. And to do that, created a new result. And we want to try and do that in the U.S. or help people do that in the U.S.
In looking at U.S. law, have you seen any kind of precedent in U.S. common law, which derives from British legal system, that could see a public inquiry like this that was run by the government, started by very conservative people, run by it, and
absolutely.
Then they turned?
I think there are precedents. I think the grand jury system, which occurs, can be modified and adapted. But I also don't see any reason why, within the framework of the Constitution, government at a local level, at a state level, or even at a federal level, cannot convene an inquiry. Immunity can be granted for people who are summoned to the inquiry. But a public inquiry, I can't find any legal reason through my research as to why it can't be convened in the U.S. in a similar sort of way. Statutes could be enacted within state legislation to do that if there was that interest and lobbying was done to create that impetus. And in that way, what you could end up with is a situation very similar to what you have in England, whereby when there is a situation of huge public concern, a political concern, an inquiry can be launched and a full investigation can take place that's independent of the police and independent of small working parties. It becomes public scrutiny of the administrative process, and that is supposed to be what America's about.
Explain what happened to the head of the inquiry in Britain. What was his name?
Sir William McPherson. He was believed to be quite a conservative figure. And when he was appointed the head of the inquiry, people thought he might be difficult to persuade at all in terms of the police misconduct. During the course of the inquiry, the immense public presence at the inquiry influenced, we believe, very strongly how the inquiry viewed the case. They could see the reaction of the public to some of the things the police were saying. That part two of the inquiry went outside the Stephen Lawrence case and went on the road. And they went to communities all over England and asked them about racial politics, about racial matters, and about policing. And as a result, it appears that Sir William McPherson really became far more enlightened than he might otherwise have been about race politics and about policing. And so he made very critical remarks about the policing. And in a sense, he's become alienated from some of his former colleagues, it might be said, due to the position he's taken. But at the same time, he's brought with him a conservative element or an establishment element that really wouldn't have believed about police misconduct before, about racism.
We only have a minute, Matthew Ryder, but I just want to ask what actually was accomplished with the final report. I mean, what has changed in Britain?
The report made 70 recommendations. Those included things like ensuring that the police came under discrimination legislation, which previously the police had been immune from. The government has been forced to enact laws now incorporating the police into discrimination legislation. Stop and frisk policies have had to be changed. Recruitment policies of minority officers have had to be changed. Targets have been set. To give a very, very short example, two black men were found hanged within the space of a week in the north of England very recently. The Lawrence report was used as a template or a blueprint for how that sort of case should be investigated, whereas previously it might have been brushed off. The police were looking at it as suicides. Now that's changed, and hopefully the Lawrence case can have an international impact as well as a national one.
If people want to find out more about the Lawrence case, where can they go on the web?
The best website is www.blink.org.uk, or alternatively newsunlimited.co.uk/Lawrence.
And we will put those on our website at www.pacifica.org and www.democracynow.org. I want to thank you very much
for being with us,
Matthew Ryder, the attorney for the Stephen Lawrence family. And we will follow the Lawrence family if and when they come to the United States in the next week or two to meet with the Diallos. That does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, 1-800-735-0230 is the number to call. That's 1-800-735-0230. Democracy Now! Is produced by Maria Cadillac and David Love. Errol Maitland is our technical director. From the studios of WBAI in New York, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now!